Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 85 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Our mission is to bring you updates from the literature to keep you up to date so you don't have to spend as much time flipping through journals and so on. And occasionally to learn about some other stuff. You know, Michelle, what we've never talked about before on this podcast?
What have we never talked about, Luke?
Malpractice.
Ding, 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 ding.
And we decided that it was time for us to break that trend, and we have an expert with us today. This is Jennifer Wiggins, I guess I'll let you introduce yourself and tell us exactly what you do.
Perfect. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. Yeah, my name is Jennifer Wiggins, and I am the CEO of Aegis Malpractice Solutions. So I am a malpractice insurance nerd. I've been doing nothing but malpractice insurance for 20 years. So I love coming on and talking to people to help kind of demystify this topic and hopefully make it a little bit easier for providers to understand.
I like to think that one reason I don't think about malpractice more often is A, that I probably am unlikely to have anything too horrible happen to me, and B, well, I'm part of this giant academic institution, which I assume will take care of me. It's probably in the contract somewhere if anything does go south. So I don't know if that's why we don't spend as much time talking about this or if I'm just wrong.
I think you're probably right. I also think what we've discovered is there's just not a lot of education surrounding malpractice insurance as doctors go through residency and fellowship. So I think there's a little bit of a gap there. And then I also think, to your point, you know, for healthcare providers who either work for a hospital or an educational institution or their malpractice insurance is provided for them, there's really no reason for them to spend a whole bunch of time learning how to buy it. So those are probably the two biggest reasons.
So what do you think is most important for doctors to know or medical students before they get out there, especially if they may not be in one of these large centers that takes care of them?
Yeah, we spend quite a bit of time educating residents and fellows. We do like a MedMal 101 course. And I would say the topics that are probably of most interest and most applicable to everybody are probably just the basics, right? Like, what is malpractice? What is the standard of care? What are doctors expected to do? And what causes claims? Why do doctors get sued? We also teach them a little bit about just what that claim process looks like, because if you've never been sued, you probably have no idea what it actually feels like and how long it actually takes to live through a claim. But we talk a lot about then how do you prevent it? So what are the risk management techniques and things you need to be thinking about to not get sued? And then obviously there's the practical stuff like how do you buy insurance? So what kind of insurance should I buy? How much coverage should I buy? All of those different things that we generally cover in that course, and we can dive into any of those topics, whatever you think would be of most interest.
I like the basics. Let's start with the basics.
Yeah. Yeah. So we could start with just what is it, right? So what is malpractice? And so, I mean, it's a pretty general definition, but it's, you know, anything that deviates from the standard of care that results in harm to a patient. So when it comes to why doctors get sued or kind of what's that litmus test of what is, you know, an actual case and what's not, has to do with this elusive standard of care issue. So how do we determine if a doctor has or hasn't met the standard of care? Well, it's kind of a moving target. And so the way that attorneys demonstrate that a doctor either has or hasn't met that standard is to bring in expert witnesses. So if you're a dermatologist and you get sued, when you go to court and you're sitting in the stand, you have an expert witness on the defense side, and you'll have expert witnesses on the plaintiff side. And they're going to look at the facts of the case. And they're going to basically ask this one question. They're going to say, is Dr. X's behavior, did he or she do what another dermatologist with the same situation, same training, same facts, would they have done the same exact thing or something within reason? So doctors aren't expected to be perfect. Nobody's perfect. But what the, you know, judge and jury is looking for is, was your behavior and your response and your treatment in line with what a similar provider would have done under the same circumstances?
And it sounds like the term harm might also be a little bit fuzzy. So if I don't cause medical harm, but somebody has to pay an extra $5,000 in tests, does that meet the definition of harm?
Yeah, I mean, it's also harm. It's also related to did what you do cause the harm? Because there could have been harm that came from something else. So, for example, we've seen examples where, you know, a patient comes into the emergency room and they are seen by an ER doctor. They get treatment, and then they go home, and then the patient dies. Well, why did the patient die? There has to be a correlation between the treatment that was rendered or what should have been rendered and the harm that was caused. So yeah, there's a lot of those little legal elements that have to be linked together in order to prove that, number one, you had to have a duty to treat the patient, right? You had to breach that duty. The breach had to have caused harm. And then obviously the harm has to be in relation to, you know, your specific actions or lack of actions. So that's all part of the elements of the legal system to try to prove that there was or wasn't malpractice.
So you mentioned that you talk about how to avoid it, or risk mitigation or safety measures. What should I be doing that I'm not doing?
Yeah. You know, so there was a really, I'm going to try to pull up this acronym that I actually overheard the other day, and I thought it was really genius. There's an OBGYN named Dr. Laura Fortner, and so I'm going to give her credit because I'm stealing her acronym. So she uses the acronym AVOID, and it's really four key things that physicians should do to help avoid a malpractice case. And the first letter of that is A, which is your attitude. So essentially your bedside manner, right? So this is like one of those things that seems super, super simple, and yet it has the most direct correlation to your relationship to your patient and how likely they are to sue you. So how likable are you, right? When you come in, are you slowing down? Are you sitting down next to the patient? Are you showing that you care? Are you not just typing away in your electronic health record and not making any eye contact? So it's really important that doctors are having a positive attitude and spending a lot of time developing that relationship with the patient and having an excellent bedside manner. That is one of the number one reasons why doctors get sued a lot of times, because we've seen examples where maybe there was a little bit of negligence, but if the patient really loves their doctor, they're probably not going to sue them. So having that rapport with the patient really does go a really long way. And so attitude / bedside manner is the first of the A in AVOID.
That's kind of easy for us clinical dermatologists to try to cultivate and work on. It's a little bit weirder when you're a dermatopathologist or a radiologist or somebody and you're not actually ever seeing the patient.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that, because we see that in the claim data. So, you know, there are certain types of providers that unfortunately they just have a little bit higher claim frequency. And it's not that they're more likely that they're doing something wrong. It's just that they don't have the ability to develop that relationship. So you're exactly right. Pathologists, radiologists, even emergency medicine and urgent care providers to a certain extent, sometimes even hospitalists get looped into that, because you don't have the long time relationship where a primary care or a dermatologist or an OB or somebody that's seeing the same patient year over year over year, it's much harder for them to have that benefit.
Right. And I'm sorry I interrupted. What's the
V? No, you're fine. Feel free anytime to jump in. The V that we try to teach people is to value the patient's perspective. So basically, it's important for doctors to put themselves in the patient's shoes. So, you know, doctors are super busy. They're churning through patients, seeing lots of people in a given day. And so sometimes when you are encountering a situation that's particularly difficult, it's really important for you to just remember that you have to stop and put yourself in their position. So doctors are very smart. They know a lot about the medicine. They know a lot about the science. Your patient doesn't know that. So when you walk into a room and a patient's just had, let's just say you've discovered cancer or something fairly serious that you now need to talk to them about, you just have to put on that empathy hat and really make sure you're looking at it from their position. So valuing their perspective is the V in avoid. The O that we teach people is to try to operate in systems. So especially when you're in the clinical setting, try to have a system for everything in your office. So basically the way you do it is always the way that you do it. So you have a process for incoming patients. You have a process for dismissing patients. You have a process for how you document. Be as organized as you possibly can, because mess equals lawsuit. You know, a messy lawsuit can come across as unorganized. Sometimes it can come across as incompetence in the eyes of a patient. And also, if you're just moving too fast and you don't have a system, you're more likely to make a mistake. So it's really important that you have really strong operating procedures in place, and you and your staff all know the way we do it is always the way that we do it. So everything is triaged the same way. Documentation is done the same way. Communication is always done the same way. So those systems can really kind of save you, especially when life gets hectic.
Huh. That makes a lot of sense, though. I will admit it's kind of hard for me to imagine doing what I do without all of those systems in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems like it'd be super inefficient.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, you know, when I walk into an office, sometimes we'll have like a risk manager will come in and we'll come in and meet with clients to try to help them mitigate risk in their practice. When you walk into an office and you just see a stack of patient files on the front desk, or a disheveled office manager, or there's just this frenzy, you know, think about it from the patient's perspective. When they're walking in for their appointment and they see that, do they feel like you're competent, and that do they feel comfortable walking in and having a procedure done at your office? I don't know. I mean, it just, again, comes across as causing a little more question probably in their mind in terms of the care that they're going to be given by you.
That makes sense. All right. What's the I?
I is initiate self-care. So physicians are, you know, by nature, people, usually workaholics. They can also be a little bit of perfectionists. So it's always just good to remember that you are also human. So take your day off. When you're away from the office, be present with your family and friends. Recharge, refill your tank, do the things that you love and that give you joy, so that when you return to your office and you're with your patients again, you're pouring into them because your cup has been filled. So take care of yourself so that you can take care of your patients.
And if you are a very practical person and you think something like, okay, fine, but we're in the eat what you kill model, and the more patients I see, the more money I get. Well, keep in mind that apparently seeing too many people might increase your risk of being sued for malpractice. And then what
That's
are you going to do with all that money?
That's
Give it
right.
to somebody else, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a delicate balance, right? I mean, you do want to work hard, and especially early in your career, we see doctors just cranking through, but you guys probably know from either your own personal experience or talking to peers, burnout is a very real thing. So I can't tell you how many articles I see about physician burnout coming across my desk. And obviously burnout leads to, you know, mistakes. And so malpractice is a very real threat when it comes to that too.
And this is also an argument to organizations who employ doctors to let them have some time off.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So the D in our acronym AVOID is probably what you're expecting me to say, which is document, document, document. So
I did expect you to say that. It's true.
So keep your documentation consistent, thorough, and timely. Don't get caught up into the template philosophy where all you're doing is just clicking boxes and moving through and copying and pasting. Make sure that you're clearly explaining your thought process and the reason why you did what you did. It's important that you're documenting your rationale. So why did you choose to go with option A versus option B in this particular patient's care? You know, you've got to realize too that but by the time you actually see the patient, if there is an adverse outcome or something bad happens, it could be 2-3 years from now before they actually file a lawsuit against you. And if you haven't documented thoroughly and really explained the facts of their care, what you did, why you chose to do what you did. You're not going to remember that 3 years from now when you get deposed and now you've got to recall the specific interaction you had with that patient. So documentation will save your bacon, but it'll also help you remember what you were doing and why you chose to do what you did, which will help you justify the care that you rendered at that particular time.
It's probably good medicine too, to write down why you decided to do what you did so that, you know, even if you don't get sued 3 months later, if you're trying to remember your thought process, you can see it there. Or if one of the patient's other healthcare providers wants to know why you did what you did, well,
yeah,
there it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So sorry, go over them all again. The A was
attitude,
being a good person, the
attitude or bedside manner. V, value the patient's perspective. O,
I'm sorry,
operate
I'm not
in systems.
Remember. Just go for it. Yeah.
I, initiate self-care, and D, document, document, document.
Cool. Well, I think that's probably a good little malpractice in a nutshell. Thanks for joining us. Michelle, did you have any other questions for Jennifer before we say goodbye?
If you were going to like pick the one thing that you would just love for any client that you have to know, what would that be?
I think the most important thing is for you to be your own advocate when it comes to malpractice, not only as it relates to mitigating risk in your practice, especially if you're in the clinical setting, but also if you are employed, that you know enough to be able to advocate for yourself at the time that you sign your contract. So know what you should have, know what's important to you. So that way, you know, heaven forbid something happens down the road, you can ensure that you've got a policy that's really going to activate and cover you. Because when it comes to malpractice, I mean, it is protection for not only your assets, so how much money you have to pay, but this is reputation coverage. So you really want to make sure that you are your own advocate as you're discussing with potential employers or buying it for yourself so that you can get a policy that's really going to give you the protection that you need.
Awesome.
Sounds good. Well, earlier you mentioned that you actually have a podcast about malpractice, so I'm assuming that's one place people can go if they want to learn more. And if there's any other places where people can find you or more information about malpractice, where can we go?
Yeah. So our website is aegismalpractice.com, and we are malpractice insurance brokers. So our job is essentially to help doctors get quotes in case they need to buy their own coverage. But education is also a big part of what we do. And so we do have a weekly podcast called Malpractice Insights. Every week, we drop a new episode on YouTube and all the podcast platforms, and they're 10-minute episodes on all sorts of content related to malpractice insurance. So questions that you might have, such as what's the difference between occurrence and claims made coverage? What is tail insurance and why do I need to buy it? What do I do when I'm getting ready to retire? What does the claim process look like? All of those types of things are just samples of what we talk about. But they're quick pops of information, hopefully, to help you along your way as you practice medicine.
I'm going to subscribe. So Malpractice Insights was what it was?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
You have a new subscriber. I was saying before we started that the ACGME actually requires residency programs to have ongoing education on malpractice. And sometimes finding ways to meet that metric are difficult. So I personally am planning on listening to this and probably using it as a flipped classroom style type teaching for my residents, because I think that, you know, kind of snackable nuggets of information over time is a more effective way to teach that information, especially since it's outside our wheelhouse compared to medical things.
Snackable nuggets. You mean like instead of a giant hour-long bolus that you imbibe every 2 weeks?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with a good meal either. So.
All right. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. We'll
see
you next
time. Thank
you,
guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Michelle, I have great news.
I'm so excited for this.
You don't have to be too sad that we just said goodbye to Jennifer Wiggins, because we have another guest right now. This is Dr. Tony Pikus, who has a PhD in clinical psychology, coming to us from Australia. Dr. Pikus, thanks so much for joining us. Do you want to start by saying hello and introducing yourself?
Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much for having me along. I'm so excited to be here bright and early in Australia. I am, as you mentioned it, a clinical psychologist and postdoctoral researcher at Swinburne University in Melbourne. And I specialize in working with patients with body dysmorphic disorder. And I've also recently actually co-founded an organization called ReadyMind, which is designed to provide cosmetic psychology services and help dermatologists and cosmetic surgeons and practitioners screen for body dysmorphic disorder and other psychosocial issues within their practice.
It's awesome.
And on episode 78, we discussed one of your articles, which was discussing what's sometimes called the zoom effect, which is that people don't like how they look on camera. I'm looking at myself right now, seeing things I don't like to see, but I'm not going to let it get to me too much because I read your article. And you've got a number of other articles focused on body dysmorphic disorder, or I guess what you guys in the biz call BDD. And it's not something we've discussed very much here. So let us know what we should be knowing or discussing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So body dysmorphic disorder, or as you said, BDD, is a psychiatric condition where people become preoccupied with a concern in their physical appearance that is really slight or potentially non-existent to other people. So to them, it feels very distressing, very real. But then when somebody else would look at them, they might not be able to see it at all. And so because of that, often people with BDD can have quite poor insight into the psychological nature of the concern. So they might actually go to dermatologists or cosmetic surgeons or to other health professionals to try to fix their appearance before they even come and see a psychologist. So it's a really interesting space that, you know, I can do a lot of helpful work in that area, but a lot of the time people with BDD might not come to see me first. They'll go to see another professional.
I think we're used to people coming to see us before they see a mental health provider for a variety of issues. It's a frustration.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important, I think, for dermatologists to be like wised up about BDD and to know what it looks like and how it might present. Because that could be the first time they're actually making contact with someone in the health field as well.
Absolutely.
So I often will tell patients, we are all our own worst critic when they're pointing out things that they don't like. And of course, there's a part of that that's just human nature, I think. I don't like this little wrinkle on my forehead, but I'm pretty sure nobody else knows that it's there. And then there's a part when it becomes BDD, I suppose. And I remember learning from medical school that a lot of the times that line is crossed once it impacts people's ability to do acts of daily living or do the things that they want to do. Is that the case for BDD?
Yeah, that's correct. So there are a few kind of defining features. So the one is that it causes excessive preoccupation with appearance. And so that often can be thinking about your appearance for more than about an hour a day. Then it's that they engage in repetitive behaviors in relation to their appearance, so trying to kind of fix or check or hide or cover up parts of themselves. And one of those checking behaviors can be the process of actually going to see a dermatologist or a cosmetic surgeon and trying to get different skin treatments potentially. And then the key things are causing distress to some degree and interference in one's life, their social life or their work life.
So people don't usually come to me with cosmetic concerns because, first of all, 70% of my patients are kids. And second of all, I'm not a cosmetic dermatologist. Every so often somebody will be like, oh, well, I'm here. How about this spot? But Michelle, you do a lot more cosmetics than I do.
Yeah.
Have you seen people that you suspect have BDD? What are some of the tip-offs, you know, without going into too much detail about how they spend their hours every day about figuring out if they fall into this category?
You know, one thing that I noticed, partially I think because of our preoccupation, as it were, as dermatologists with the visual, is that people will focus almost exclusively on a single facial feature out of proportion to the rest of their face. So like often there will be this sort of monoptic focus, for example, like on the lips or something like that. And the person will have had a lot of treatments in that area out of proportion to everything else on their body or face. And they're so focused on that one feature, they don't see how disharmonious it's become with the rest of their appearance because all they see is that thing. So it's almost like when they look in the mirror, all they see is, you know, their lips or whatever. And I empathize with these patients because as an identical twin, I don't know if you know this part about me, Dr. Pius, but I'm an identical twin. And I had a dermoid cyst on my nose that created kind of a scar. And that's actually how they told us apart when we were children. So they'd be like, oh, you can tell that's Michelle. Michelle's the one with the scar, right? And for my adolescence, and I think that this BDD, there's a period of development in adolescence where this kind of thing happens a lot. A lot of teenagers experience, I think, sort of transient partial symptoms of that. But I used to really kind of think about my nose a lot because it was the thing that made me different from my sister. Obviously, a scar is a defect, you know, and it was something that took up a lot of attention when I was a teenager. And as I grew and became more comfortable and confident in myself, it faded to the periphery and I don't think about it as much. But I think that sometimes people with BDD get stuck in that almost developmental stage where there's this hyper focus on this one thing. And there's sometimes some magical thinking around it. Like, if I can just correct this, then my life will fall into place. My luck will change. I'll find that significant other I've been looking for, because this is all that's standing between me and my perfect life of happiness, which, of course, is not true. Like, there's no magical, like, plastic surgery that's going to help you find the love of your life and the perfect job and all these things. But people really truly believe that. And so they set themselves up for disappointment. And then there's this kind of relentless pursuit of this impossible outcome. What I loved in one of your articles was you talked about an instrument. And physicians like these assessment instruments because even for those of us who maybe aren't as able to perceive people's general emotional state from their behavior and appearance, like some people are better at intuiting how another person is feeling internally than others. But I think having a scale is so useful. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the research suggests that having a scale or an instrument in a dermatology setting, in a cosmetic setting, is so important because nobody walks through the door saying like, hello, I've got BDD, you know, I need to go see a psychologist. And that's often not something that comes up at all. There's often such a high degree of shame associated with BDD that even when they do come see a psychologist, it can often get missed or take time before it actually comes through in sessions. So definitely, like, I recommend completely that everyone has a screening tool that they use for body dysmorphic disorder and other psychosocial issues. And so there's a brief one called the Body Dysmorphic Disorder Questionnaire that's been adapted to a dermatology setting. So that's the dermatology version. It's 5 items, really quick to administer. And they're scaled questions on a 5-point scale. So that one's a really nice one to use, quick and easy. I'm actually also working with ReadyMind as well on developing a bit more of a comprehensive automated screening package. So it's even easier, hopefully, for a dermatologist to do that will look at things like BDD, but also other psychological issues that might present in these settings, like perfectionism, for example, and depression and anxiety and unrealistic expectations for treatment as well, particularly for cosmetic treatments.
I love that. I think that's awesome. And those tools that can be accessible and used relatively quickly can also provide documentation in the chart as to maybe why you don't do a procedure for a patient. Because I've had the experience of having a patient that came to me who had what I will refer to as Instagram lips. So they are basically in pursuit of a Kylie Jenner pout. And she was already out of proportion and wanted more in my practice, and she was very young and her face was not going to support another syringe of filler in her lip, which is what she wanted. And so I told her that, you know, I think that, you know, your lips are actually, you know, very enhanced. And, you know, I think we need to work on maybe balance with some other parts of your face. And I think in the conversation, I tried to be very gentle and, you know, thoughtful of her concerns, but she was furious that I would not do this. She said, it's my right as a patient to have this done. And when somebody has that level of disconnect over an elective procedure, especially rage when you say no, I think that that is a big indicator of how significant the emotions around this particular disorder can be, because, you know, of course, anxiety and depression get tied into this, but so sometimes do strong negative emotions that can be externally or internally directed. And there's a lot of, you know, self-destruction, I think, for patients who have BDD. But you also have to be aware that these are patients who can also get very angry with the people taking care of them. And it's a warning sign. So I think having that documentation would be very helpful medical legally. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I know in America in particular, there have been cases of legal action. There's even been, I think, a couple of cases of murder against a practitioner by a patient with BDD because they were so disappointed with the treatment outcomes. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely worth having that documentation for medical legal purposes to say that you've screened and that you've use that potentially as a rationale not to provide a certain treatment, or a rationale why it was okay to provide a certain treatment at the time. And I think that's really important, but also having that confidence to say no when you don't feel like it's in your patient's best interests, and coming back to that principle of do no harm, and keeping in mind that, you know, by proceeding with a treatment that's actually not going to help this individual, it can do harm, whether that's physical or psychological, and whether that's in the short term or long term, by you saying no, you're agreeing to do no harm to that individual, and that you've got their best interests at heart.
So we're swinging a little bit at what do you do if you do have a patient who you suspect have this, and it sounds like we should somehow gently not do whatever it is that they request, and I assume send them to Dr. Tony Picus for a virtual visit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do see patients virtually, so that would absolutely be an option. But I also think it's a great idea for dermatologists and people working in the cosmetic industry to have a relationship with a psychologist in their local area who works with body image issues and BDD, and to build that close relationship so it's very easy to refer patients there if needed, and to let your patients know that it's a common process, that it's something that you do regularly. They're not the only one. There's not something that's specifically wrong with them, but this is a normal thing that you do as part of their holistic care. I think that could be really helpful.
My sense is that a lot of people would be resistant to going to a mental health provider for this. Do you feel that that's true?
Yeah, I think it's different for everyone. I think a lot of the time when people are seeking a cosmetic fix, there is a bit of resistance to getting psychological support. But the way I see it is almost like planting the seed, that if you have that conversation with them, it might not sink in then, and they might not want to go see a psychologist straight away, but they will remember that conversation. And so at a later stage, it might come up again. Oh yeah, I remember that dermatologist said that I was feeling really distressed or anxious about my appearance. Maybe I should go talk to someone. Maybe they can help. So if it doesn't help at the time, I think it will help eventually.
I hope so. Awesome. We need to do this motivational interviewing thing again. Medical school again coming to haunt my dreams. And go ahead, Michelle.
I was going to say one thing that you had an article about that I thought was so fascinating, and was one of the things I think we discussed, was the Zoom effect. And I think part of that is, depending on how the computer is set up and the camera is set up, our brains actually learn to sort of Photoshop our own faces when we look in the mirror in the way that we're used to looking at it. So if you're presented with an image of your face that is your mirror image, you actually will like it better than the image of your face that everyone else sees, because your brain is used to seeing your face and reflection. And that's actually an old trick photographers use, where if they have a picture that a client doesn't like of themselves, they'll say, oh, I'm going to do some retouching. And they basically just flip the negative and turn it around so the brain is seeing a reflection instead of a true image. And then the brain's autocorrect works on that face because it's learned to do that over time. And it's like, oh yeah, that looks great. I look good. Because you're like, brain's like, oh yeah, no, my eyebrows are even in position. This one's not higher. Or like, you know, my chin's the same size on both sides. And that's something I've found also as a person who does cosmetic dermatology is very important to point out to people in the consultation. When you do notice those little areas that are not completely symmetric, not to create any issues for the person, but to say, I always preface with, everybody's face has slight imperfections. They're completely normal. Our brain sort of Photoshops things for our well-being, so we don't notice them very much. But sometimes after a procedure, when people are looking at their face every single day, they will notice something that they've always had that they didn't perceive before. And it's also important to show that to people when you're kind of doing a consultation, to ensure that they don't kind of blame the procedure for the normal variation in anatomy everybody has. And it's so fascinating when you think about the psychology and the neurology around how our brain interprets and deals with our own face. You know, it's kind of, most of human development didn't have that ability. You might catch a fleeting glimpse of yourself in a pond or something, but until they developed the technology for mirrors over the like significant developmental period of human history, we didn't have that as a part of our own, you know, sort of natural world. So it's kind of fascinating when you think about the impact of that on humans as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then move to 2020, 2021, when we're sitting looking in a mirror pretty much all day long while we're on video. It's so interesting. And I think that patient education part of the consultation is so important. And so giving that information to patients is really valuable. I often have clients who come and see me and will repeat these sorts of things that their dermatologist has told them or their cosmetic surgeon told them. And so these little tidbits are really valuable in helping to challenge the BDD and sometimes like the unhelpful thinking processes that they're engaging in.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Dr. Pikus, but before we let you go, I think our listeners might want to know a little bit more about this BDD questionnaire for dermatology. So I just got it pulled up here. It starts with one question. Are you very concerned about the appearance of some part of your body which you consider especially unattractive? And if they say, no, I'm not concerned, then you're done. So if you're looking for an easy screening question, that could be one. But if they say, yes, I am especially concerned about an especially unattractive part of my body, then you move on to, do these concerns preoccupy you? Do you think about them a lot? What are your concerns? What effect has the preoccupation on your appearance have been on your life? And then you have a scale of 1 to 5 for various things. And then you end with, has your defect often significantly interfered with your schoolwork, your job, etc.? And are there things you avoid because of your defect? So listeners, you can pull that up if you're interested in screening some patients. Dr. Pikus, thank you so much for joining us. Are there places when people can find out more about you, websites, social media, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got a website, which is www.readymind.com.au. And then also on social media, on Instagram, I'm the BDD therapist, where I post tips about dealing with body dysmorphic disorder. I also cater to cosmetic surgeons and dermatologists and letting them know about BDD and what to do when they find it in their practice.
That's awesome.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your morning. It's evening the day before where we are. So we're talking to you from the future.
Thank you so much for having me along. And I hope you guys have a good night. Well, I enjoy my day.
That was so interesting. What a wonderful guest Dr. Pikus was.
And what a great accent.
I know. We'd love to have her back anytime she's happy to come back. So speaking of cosmetics, we're going to stay on a similar topic for a little while. We're going to go over this article from the Journal of Cosmetic Dermatology entitled Overview of High-Risk Food and Drug Administration Recalls for Cosmetics and Personal Care Products from 2002 to 2016. The authors are Timothy Genetos, Lisa Akintillo, and Shuizu, I think. I'm not sure I'm saying that properly. They are from Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, and McGaw Medical Center of Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois.
Cosmetic recalls.
Yes.
So nicely combining the legal matters and the cosmetic matters of our previous two guests.
Exactly. And we're even going to talk about like laws and how they're passed. I mean, something
exciting.
For everything. I know, and riveting, you know.
By the way, listeners, this is also a CertLink article if you're interested in maintaining your certification that way.
We could do a little like Schoolhouse Rock, if you're a bell, if you're only. Anyway, so this is going to be talking about how cosmetics are regulated. So long story short, cosmetics are not regulated very much at all. Cosmetics are regulated by the FDA. They have significant authority over pharmaceuticals and devices, as we're all well aware, by the different trials that are needed to get a medication approved by the FDA, similar for a device. There is very limited regulatory oversight of cosmetics with no pre-approval mechanism for cosmetics outside of color additives. So the only thing you have to get pre-approved to put a cosmetic product on the market is the color additives. Everything else in there, no regulation is over that at all.
So I could mix up like 3 different moisturizers and put them in a bottle and say, I'm going to go sell this. And
exactly.
The FDA would be like, cool, you do you, entrepreneurship, huzzah.
Unless you were causing problems for other people or put some unapproved color additives in there to make it look snazzy, you could probably get away with that.
I'm making an Etsy account right now.
I'm going to make Luke's Blue Goo. It solves all your problems.
Oh, but the blue might have to go through the FDA.
Oh, see, that's right. The blue, that would create a problem. So when do you think the last important cosmetic legislation was passed? So the last legislation to actually protect consumers and to do any kind of job of that comprehensively was passed.
Let's see. When did we last care about consumers as a society? I'm going to say the 40s.
You are so close. 1938, the Cosmetics Act of 1938.
It's been almost 100 years since we've cared about consumers, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. So 1938 was the last significant, meaningful legislation. There was a bill that was passed. This was to basically have respect to the scope of new chemical exclusivity. So it was more about defining the active ingredient more narrowly as an active moiety in certain circumstances when you're bringing a new drug to market. So that was kind of to allow for some market exclusivity period, providing priority review of drugs for rare pediatric diseases and redefinition of the active moiety. So for consumer products that are actually going to affect consumers writ large, really the last meaningful legislation was in 1938. So there was a bill proposed that might do a great job of helping to kind of make the cosmetic world a little bit safer for consumers, which is the Personal Care Product Safety Act, which was introduced in 2015 and reintroduced in 2021 by Senator Dianne Feinstein. And the point of this bill, which has not passed yet, is to basically kind of give the FDA the ability to evaluate the safety of 5 ingredients per year. And it would prioritize those ingredients based off of reported bad interactions or bad reactions to them. So the first 5 ingredients they proposed, and these I think are pimpable, was diadenosylurea. That is a formaldehyde-containing preservative that is able to trigger allergic contact to dermatitis in a lot of people. Lead acetate, which is kind of scary that that's still allowed in our topical products. Methylene glycol, methane diol, or formaldehyde, all the same thing. Propylparaben. And quaternium 15. So all of these are used as preservatives. All of them can be agents of contact dermatitis. So this is something that would potentially benefit the cosmetic regulation and the oversight that we might have over these products.
So the bill is just asking the FDA to evaluate their safety.
Exactly. Yes.
It's not actually asking anything to be regulated. It's just saying, let's look more into this.
It's basically giving some power to the FDA to review these ingredients. And then, of course, if it was to find those ingredients to be dangerous, then some type of action could be taken where the use of them could either be limited or banned. It would be the possibility. And, you know,
sounds
to give you
totally reasonable.
I mean, you know, especially ones that we know cause a lot of problems. The bill has been read, but it has not been passed into law. So reading a bill is a first step in kind of getting it on the docket to vote on it. I think that there are processes in some ways, if you're part of your state's medical association that interacts with your lawmakers, their policies are somewhat similar where it can be read. In this particular case, it was referred to a committee on health, labor, and pensions so that that can be looked at. So in this particular article, these authors kind of undertook the analysis of all recalls of cosmetic and personal care products from 2002 to 2016. So this was an observational study where they used the Freedom of Information Act to determine the different types of reactions and recalls that had been reported and sort of kind of clarify what categories they fell into, how meaningful that was, and what that means for consumers. So risks are classified by risk to the patient's safety. So the recalls are based off of how risky the thing is to the patient. With class 1 being the most serious, this means there's a reasonable probability of causing serious adverse health outcomes or death. Class 2, the product may cause temporary or reversible adverse health consequences, or risk of serious harm is remote. So it's a little bit less dangerous. And class 3 recalls would be the product is unlikely to cause an adverse health consequence, but may be recalled. They found 14 class 1 highest, most serious recalls. So 14 class 1 recalls, 266 class 2 recalls, and 33 class 3 recalls. These were largely compromised of baby products. So baby products had the largest product category that accounted for about 24% of all recalls. And 76% of recalls were actually due to bacterial colonization, which is very distressing, especially when I get to the part about which types of bacteria it was. Can you take a guess, Luke?
Well, I could, but I've read the article, so it wouldn't be fair. By the way, this is November 2002 to December 2016, so 100 and 14 or whatever you said over that time frame. Almost 300 recalls over that time frame.
Yes, almost 300 recalls, 14 of which were class one most serious recalls. So the most common reason for that was bacterial contamination, followed by unapproved components, labeling issues, or causing skin irritation. The 14 class one recalls accounted for 1.9 million products in distribution. So that's a lot of products in distribution with the potential to cause serious adverse health outcomes or death. So several of these were actually eye care products that had Pseudomonas contamination. So as one might presume, Pseudomonas aeruginosa is not an organism you want in close proximity to your eyeballs. There are some cases, of course, also for people having issues with contact lenses because of Pseudomonas contamination. That's a pretty dangerous bacteria to have near your eye. And that was a lot of different eye makeups, as well as some non-eye makeup preps. Anything that close to a mucous membrane is a little disconcerting with bacterial contamination. They also found some topical products that were contaminated with Serratia marcescens or with Burkholderia capacia. I'm not sure how you say this word, sepacea. So that's kind of impressive that they had that level of bacterial contamination. There was a case control study that looked actually at kind of one of the things that would be, I suppose, a headliner for this. Now, they point out the fact that in 2013, Johnson & Johnson received this significant media attention because of baby powder and talc and its association with ovarian cancer. And when I was reading that 2013, I was like, I feel like we talked about this in medical school. So I went back and searched the literature, and the earliest good report on this was in 1989 in the American Journal of Epidemiology, where they did a case control study. And they found that there was an influence of perineal exposure to talc in borderline ovarian tumors. And I thought that was very interesting that that information's been around from 1989, and in 2013 was when the kind of lawsuits actually went forward at that time. So that
this article states that there have been additional studies that have not shown a link between talc and ovarian cancer.
And we're not taking a side of that debate, but that is an interesting kind of regulatory example of how these kinds of different things can go forward. So I thought that was pretty interesting. They had some concerns over cosmetics that might cause cancer. About 41% of consumer-submitted adverse events related to cancer risk, which I think is significant and something people think about a lot when they're putting something on their skin, especially as we, you know, focus more on things that should and shouldn't be on or close to our bodies. There also was a period of time where there was a type of hair product called Wen that got a lot of media attention for potentially having a role in causing some alopecia or severe contact dermatitis. And the manufacturer actually had over 21,000 complaints. So that went to a class action lawsuit, which is how a lot of these products end up being sort of dealt with, are these class action lawsuits. There is not a lot of oversight, partially because the agency that is supposed to do this is relatively underfunded and underpowered to do so. So the Office of Cosmetics and Color is the specific entity in our government that's supposed to look at this stuff. And they have a $13 million budget, which sounds like a lot of money, but for something that is looking at a lot of products nationally, that's probably not enough for them to be able to do their job properly. The FDA also has an adverse event reporting system, the CAERS for cosmetics. And that suggests serious underreporting of adverse events related to cosmetics. And that is a call to action that the authors put forward in this article, that as dermatologists who are probably on the front line of a lot of these reactions to these products, that we should be helping our patients to find the right lanes to complain or act through. And also, when we see something significant, that we should speak up on the behalf of patients.
And it looks like we can use this system to do it. So I think it's called the CARES database, C-A-E-R-S. Yes. So if you, especially if you see a rash, of patients who are reacting to the same product, this is one way that we can do something. And one reason why the authors wrote this article to bring this kind of thing to our attention.
And, you know, some of the things that were interesting also that came out of this was that some manufacturers have more problems with this than others, as you might guess. So, for example, a single manufacturer accounted for 13% of all recalls, and these tended to be baby and adult cleansing wipes and products dedicated for people in the hospital, which sounds like a bad group of people to potentially have contaminated products with bacteria, things like newborn and infant cleansing kits for hospital use, things being contaminated with bacteria under those circumstances, a little bit terrifying. And currently there's only these 6 inspectors that are responsible for more than 3 million shipments of imported cosmetics.
Those are the people looking at like the international stuff. So if you were listening to this and you're like, I bet most of those 300s are from China. Actually, they're almost all United States manufacturers. Part of it 99%. Might be because, part of it might be because the recall is voluntary, right? The FDA has no power. They can't require you to recall your product. So all of these were voluntary, and maybe domestic manufacturers are more likely to voluntarily recall their products. But it's true that there's only 6 people looking through all of the shipments that we get from other countries and being like, well, this is looks like what it says it is, and so on.
Yeah, and there's also a problem. They didn't directly touch on this in this article, but it's something I'm aware of, where a lot of these companies will just set up all these shell companies. They'll sell a whole bunch of product and then close the company down officially. And then the company is gone before people start reporting adverse events. And by the time there's even an awareness there's an issue, the company has disappeared into the ether, only to reappear later under a different name, peddling probably the same product under a different packaging to unsuspecting consumers. So I thought that this shone a very nice light on the level of dysregulation that exists around topical cosmetics, as well as the level of potential danger. It is a good call to action for dermatologists to be advocates for our patients, both on an individual basis, as well as potentially by supporting legislation that would allow for more transparency and monitoring of some of these ingredients.
Yeah. Interesting to see this stuff, and the cosmetics industry is huge, so 300 recalls over the course of 15 years might not really be all that much compared to how much product is put out there. So I'd like to at least say it seems like the companies are generally doing a good job, but when it goes south, you know, newborn babies with bacterial contamination in their hospital wipes is pretty scary sounding. So if you work for a company, listener, or you're in charge of a company, just be cool, all right? Be cool. Speaking of things that are cool, is Aplasia cutis congenita cool?
So cool. No. So hot right now. So hot. Yeah.
Okay, that was my segue.
It has everything. It has a hair color. It has shiny looking skin with a scar and no features of any hair follicles, which is really cool. And then if it's there in presence with something else, it might be a double hit sign where you have to go do some imaging, which is always an interesting discussion to have with parents.
Okay, well, you took care of that article in one sentence, so we'll see you next time, listeners. we should talk about it. So this is another CertLink article. This one's out of Pediatric Dermatology, and it's called Low Risk of Clinically Important Central Nervous System Dysraphism in a Cohort Study of 69 Patients with Isolated Aplasia Cutis Congenita of the Head. So I'm a pediatric dermatologist. I see a lot of babies, and they're cute. I love seeing babies, and sometimes they have Aplasia Cutis Congenita. This is when you've got an area of skin that's not there at birth. So it's not actually an area of skin. It's an area of not skin, where normally there's skin. We most commonly see it on the vertex scalp. So when I envision Aplasia cutis congenita in my head, I envision the baby with a spot on the scalp. And the pathogenesis is varied depending on what it looks like and so on. So sometimes probably the skin cells just didn't end up migrating over that area. Sometimes there may have been some kind of vascular compromise, and so the area necrosed a little bit. There's probably other issues as well. It's somewhat uncommon, but we definitely see it. And sometimes it's associated with problems. So reports include issues with the underlying bone or dura. Remember, the dura is the thick membrane that covers the brain. And about 15 to 30% of patients with aplasia cutis have abnormalities of their underlying bone or dura, apparently. You can also get ectopic neural tissue. You can get atretic connections, which means like an old connection that's not really valid anymore. And then you can also have true encephaloceles, etc., that require neurosurgical correction. And then you mentioned the hair color sign. That could be suggestive, but what are the chances of any of this actually happening? So that's why these authors wrote this article. It's a retrospective review from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. The authors include Travis Kwemet and Stephen Humphrey. And they looked at all of their scalp aplasia cutis pediatric patients who had CTs or MRIs. All of them ever. And they found 69 patients who had them. And only one of those 69 babies had an abnormality that required neurosurgical intervention right away. That baby had an encephaloceal. Though some other patients did have findings that are probably important to know about for the future, two had a condition called sinus pericranii, for example. So if you're wondering what sinus pericranii is, it can present as a... Go ahead.
I was going to say, or what that sound was. It's the pimping bell.
Oh, yeah, the old pimping bell. Highlights testable content. So you can also get a congenital midline painless scalp mass that can be sinus pericranii, or it can be more occult. And they are venous anastomoses between extracranial and intracranial veins. So a malformation of the venous vasculature. And if they're really small, you might just keep an eye on them, which I suppose means do some serial scans based on what neurology or neurosurgery thinks. Or they can be surgically excised. If they're really big, then maybe the brain requires all of that abnormal venous outflow to work. And then a more thorough evaluation, perhaps requiring angiography, might be important. So again, do that in combination with neurosurge. So two of these 69 patients had sinus pericranii, and consistent with the previous literature, about half of this aplasia cutis was on the vertex scalp. 28% of these babies had the hair collar sign. The hair collar sign was somewhat useful, mostly in terms of its negative predictive value of 90%. So we might remember Phil Watkins from our last episode, who talked to us about sensitivity, specificity, and positive and negative predictive value and so on. So if you don't have the hair collar sign, you've got a 90% chance that you won't have abnormalities on imaging. The sensitivity and specificity and positive predictive value weren't very good, but the negative predictive value, 90% is pretty high. So maybe you could say, well, with no hair collar sign, 90% chance I won't find abnormalities on imaging. Does that mean I don't have to image? Well, does that mean there's a 10% chance there is an abnormality? But the odds of it being an abnormality that requires neurosurgical correction is very low, according to that study out of Wisconsin. So what do I do? And listeners, that's for you to decide, I suppose. What would you think, Michelle?
I think, you know, whenever you're dealing with babies, erring on the side of caution is reasonable, but you do have to realize that you are balancing that caution with the risk of the procedure. So I think that, you know, maybe for less risky cases, potentially ultrasonography, which when it's done on small babies can be very useful, might be a good intermediate. Because you either have to like starve and feed and swaddle little babies to do an MRI, or you have to sedate older babies to do that. And putting any child under, you know, general sedation is a risk. You know, ultrasounds are a little bit less complicated in that they don't have to be perfectly still, and the operators can kind of work with the baby's kind of mercurial nature and movement a little bit more easily.
Yeah, they didn't mention ultrasound at all here, but I wondered about that. In pediatric dermatology, we love our ultrasounds. You'd think an ultrasound would be pretty good at finding an encephaloceal or something right in that area of the aplasia cutis. And you would also think that it would be decent at finding something like sinus pericranii, especially if it was one that was large enough to become a problem. So I wonder if that's the future, unless there's something really obvious. You had mentioned the hair collar sign before I did, Michelle. Do you want to explain to our listeners what it looks like?
Sure. So if you have a hair collar sign, you'll have a lesion. It can be either an indentation, it can be a membrane, it can actually even sometimes be a little bump. Some patients get sort of a hypertrophic scar in the middle of their aplasia cutis, but it's a lining up with little hairs like they've been arranged like the chairs around a table almost. They're in kind of a perfect array around the central defect. And sometimes there's even a hair tuft with that where the hair is longer, darker, and thicker than the hair elsewhere on the scalp. I had a little baby that had that with a sort of attenuated membrane in the center, and then that was in the middle of a vascular malformation. So when you have a two-hit, like we mentioned there, where there's a vascular malformation and aplasia cutis congenita on top of it, greater likelihood of any kind of underlying neurological abnormality.
Yep. And why does the hair collar form? Who knows?
I actually think I know this, but I don't know if anybody... Oh. So I'm a dermatopathologist, and one of my favorite specimens, which I still have, is a biopsy somebody took from an area of aplasia cutis in a child that was like 10 or 11 or something. So they were past the developmental stages and everything like this. But it was fascinating because there was this wedge-shaped organization of the hairs. So the hair is kind of in-towed around the hole at a similar angle, basically. And I think that's what creates that sort of hair collar sign, is sort of the hair follicle's orientation around the area of loss of the tissue.
That's fascinating. So they're like plants mm-hmm. looking for sunlight. They're growing around the scar.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Well, of these 69 patients, 12 of them had some kind of abnormal findings. So that's 17%. So that was abnormal bone findings, abnormal vasculature, like the sinus pericranii or other CNS issues. So there was bone thinning, like a calvarial defect, in 6 of the 12. There was an atretic finding, like an atretic meningocele or an atretic encephalocele, in 2 of the 12. And then one person had both the bone thinning and the atretic finding, and then the 2 with sinus pericranii and the 1 with the encephalocele who required neurosurgery. Lesion size, by the way, did not predict any abnormality. So smaller doesn't necessarily mean better, and bigger doesn't necessarily mean worse. By the way, listeners and Pimping Bell, would you like to be reminded of the types of cephaloceles?
I think that's an excellent idea.
There's the encephalocele, which means that you've got brain herniating through this open space, which is no bueno. You've got a meningocele, which means there's CSF only with persistent intracranial communication. So the CSF leaks out into this space and can kind of slosh around back and forth. And then the other option is an atretic cephalocele. Atretic encephaloceles typically involve a stalk with extension from or through the dura to the extracranial space and are always skin covered, though the skin may be abnormal. In contrast to meningoceles and encephaloceles, there is no functional communication. So there's not like an open hole or a window where CSF can slosh around or brain can stick out. There's just like an old stalk there. And they are frequently associated with other CNS abnormalities, however, which may or may not have implications for functional development. And the authors say, for this reason, if an atretic cephalocele is suspected, an MRI is recommended regardless of whether or not you're going to do surgical treatment. So if an atretic cephalocele is suspected, how would you suspect an atretic cephalocele unless you already saw it on imaging, is my question. Yeah. Maybe if ultrasound shows something, we were talking about that earlier, if it's like, well, good news, no encephalocele, but there might be some kind of atretic connection, well, then I guess you'd go on to MRI.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you find something, definitely getting PD neurology and maybe even PD neurosurge like involved, just so that, you know, what the options are and what the, you know, likely course of the particular defect would be, because, you know, it's, as dermatologists that are general dermatologists, the kids scare us anyway, and then you add neurology on top of that. And I think, you know, one of the things I've learned the farther I get into my career is to not be afraid to ask for help early, because, you know, we have to remember that the world of medicine and the complexity of the human body are significant, and thinking we can be masters of all those fields all at the same time is a little egotistical. And I never want my ego to get in the way of my patients' care. So I think asking for help early with something like this is always a good idea.
One weakness of the study was it didn't include any patients who were not scanned. So we have no idea how many of those there were and why people chose not to scan them, or why clinicians chose to scan these particular babies, or if it was the parents' decision or whatever. And we also don't know the outcome of those who were not scanned. Did they have some kind of problem that wasn't picked up? So it's not perfect. There's still a lot we don't know about these aplasia cutis congenita children, but I think overall my takeaway is that if there's no hair collar sign, it's quite reassuring, and I can discuss that with the parents. You know, we can still go through with the MRI, but 9 out of 10 chance we won't find a problem, and even if we do, it's pretty unlikely that it'll be serious. What do you want to do? And engage in shared decision-making.
Shared decision-making is a good idea, I think, especially when you're dealing with, like, you know, a child. It's important for the parents to feel like they have some agency in the decision. Of course, I think it does behoove us as the physicians to be both comfortable discussing this and also comfortable disclosing where we're not experts, so that the patient can have confidence that we're all making the right decision together.
Well, thanks for joining us today, friends. And thanks to our guests who taught us things today. Thanks to Jennifer Wiggins, who taught us about malpractice. Thanks to Tony Picus, who taught us about body dysmorphic disorder. Thanks to Michelle Tarbox, who taught us about cosmetic recalls. And thanks to me, who taught us about aplasia cutis congenita. And thanks also to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. More thanks to Morgan Dykeman, member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps our social media accounts moving along. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, which is a good way to reach out and say hello. Another way to reach out and say hello is through our website, dermospherepodcast.com, where we also have links to all of the original articles we have ever discussed, and you can find our entire archive on there as well. And if you really like listening to us and have finished with the entire archive of Dermosphere, you might try us on our other podcast.
So we have another podcast that is made for the lay public, and it's called Skincast. It's a bit shorter than Dermosphere, about 15 to 20 minutes per episode. And we tend to cover one or two topics that are relevant to patients who want to learn how to take the very best care of the skin they're in. So give us a listen.
Yes, come see us over there too, and we will see you guys next time.